If lead paint is so dangerous, why the f*** is there still so much of it in houses where kids live? And that's a good question. Many countries around the world actually banned the use of lead paint in the 1920s, so we knew it was dangerous. But instead of joining them, America decided to put lead basically everywhere.
And humble lead also plays its part in preserving and protecting old and new buildings in the form of white lead for wooden structures and red lead for steel.
Wait, humble lead? It's a naturally occurring element, not Meryl Streep's Oscar speech. And also, if we're assigning personality traits to metals, why stop with humble lead? How about passionate zinc, free-spirited copper, and extremely racist tin? And it wasn't just newsreels promoting lead. The lead industry reassured us it was safe, releasing things like this colouring book inviting you to the Dutch Boys Lead Party, which sounds like the worst sex club in all of Amsterdam.
Live from the Genesis Art Supply Building on North Elston Avenue, just this side of the concrete-encrusted banks of the North Branch of the Chicago River, it's The Mike Novak Show. Still Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program, heard every Sunday on Q4 Radio and at MikeNovak.net.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. And true currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find.
It's a long way to Tipperary. That's why he's riding the Megabus. Here he is, Mike Novak.
Get ready. My favorite part of the show. One more time. Well, I got that done. Does it mean I can go home now? Am I ready to get out of here? You know that old saying where somebody says happy to be here, and then you come back with happy to be anywhere. I am. Oh, that was sad.
That's a little better.
Yeah, I am happy to be anywhere. It's been, as I wrote during my sojourn of the last 2 weeks, actually about 12 days, what a long, strange trip it's been. And, you know, the 2 weeks ago when I was here doing the show, that way it might as well have been 1967, okay? That's what it feels like to me. That's how long ago all of that was. But first of all, before I get to my my story here, I'm going to tell a little story before we get rolling with all the stuff that we usually do on the Mike Novak Show. And welcome, everybody, to the show. If you want to call in and weigh in, and if you just want to say hi and welcome back, and we're glad you survived your hospital stay. Yikes. 312-985-7834. 312-985-7834. Of course, you can always tweet at Mike Now, or you can go to Facebook, go to the Mike Novak Show. And I see Annie Haven is already there tweeting, it's that time of morning, tune in to Mike Novak's Garden Radio Show on Q4.org. And, you know, Bill Turk, you'll appreciate this. You know, she's out in California, and she's a faithful listener, and she has a wonderful Mupu tea, and it's a great product, and people should get it, and they should order it from her. Let's see, Snappy J. Dog wrote, husband. This is great. Husband, quote, is this like the hold music before Mike Now comes on? Yeah, we got a little bit late into it because I hit the wrong button and had to hit the right button. My Skinny Garden writes, Mikey, welcome back. So great to hear your voice and that you survived. So all that stuff is really, really welcome. And you can see Patrick Barry's tweet. Very funny. I like that. Somehow I've made it to radio after all these years writing. You know, it's interesting where our paths take us. Because I started as a radio guy and worked my way over to writing. Although I had written things before. But I digress. I want to thank Peggy Malecki, W.C. Turk, Sarah Batka, Lisa Albrecht, the team showed up. And, I mean, you know, it's one thing to have a team, and I'm pretty loosey-goosey with it. You know, sometimes the folks are here and sometimes they're not, but they're always here in spirit. They're always part of what I do. And last week, you guys just stepped up big time. I got to tell you a story. Here I am. Sunday morning, 9 a.m., I'm in the intensive care unit at Evanston Hospital trying to get the show, okay, because I want to hear what's going on. And at 9 a.m., I can't get the show. I'm getting the music, and the music just continues. And Bill, you and I are going to talk about that. I have no idea what happened. I know Kathleen was there, and she saw me click on it, and we were listening to music. 9 a.m. comes and goes, and music's still playing. And I probably should have refreshed, and everything would have been fine, but I didn't. And it's like 10 after, 12 after. And I'm sure my blood pressure is starting to spike because I can't get my radio program and my friends who are filling in for me to sub. And then the cardiologist walks in. And he wants to talk to me. I'm going, Doc, I'm trying to see if my show's on the air. It's my radio program, okay? And then you know, the nerve of the guy interrupts me and talks to me for 45 minutes about my heart. Come on. I got radio to do here. There are priorities in the world.
We tried to get the studio into into ICU so that you could do.
I know they wouldn't. Bill tried to get the studio there, and they just were having nothing to do with it. So the story is briefly, and I don't want to go on too long about this because people talk about their medical problems and it's gross. You know, I was rolling up my sleeves here and realized I still had a hospital band on, and I got like a bandage here, and I actually have a tube somewhere.
No, we don't want to see.
Yeah, you don't want to know about that. And Bill's wonderful wife, Anna, has provided bones, so that I can make my broth because I'm on a clear liquid diet. And did you know in the 21st century, in America, in the world, I guess, if you're on a clear liquid diet, it's really hard to get protein. You're just pounding that stuff. And they give you this other stuff, this fake stuff that has lots of protein in it, and I never remember what it's called. But we got packets of that, and, you know, I'm kind of making a tea out of it, and it's not that bad. But you're all, because you can't eat solid food, you're doing this all day long, pounding this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just find it fascinating that we haven't found a better way to get protein into people. You're going to pull over here? All right, now I knew Mr. Turk was going to weigh in on this. Have a seat, Bill.
Really quickly, I did relief work in Rwanda back in the 90s.
Wow, you're older than you look.
In the 90s during the genocide. I don't know where that came from. But one of the things we did because cholera and diphtheria and waterborne illnesses were sweeping through refugee camps was we provided Pedialyte and Ensure.
Yeah, Ensure's one of them.
And as awful as those are to taste, they actually kept people alive, brought people back to life. So
yeah. I'm not doing the Ensure because it actually has about half of the protein that this other thing, and I can't remember the name of it. Kathleen, write that someplace to me, tweet it or something so that I can tell people what it is. Not that anybody ever wants it. If you can eat real food, why would you have that stuff? But I feel like all right, here's the deal. I had this procedure done, and it was basically on my esophagus. If you're a radio guy, if you're like me in the holidays, I sing. You don't want people messing around your throat. But it needed to be done. And it could have worked out one of two ways. Well, actually, it could have worked out several ways. But I was told that probably what was going to happen is they were going to do this procedure and I was going to stay overnight and I would go home the next day. 9 days later, I get out of the hospital. There were all kinds of complications. But as you can hear, one of them was not the voice, for good or evil. Because I'm sure there's some people go, oh, my God, is he going to sing again? Oh, no, please, anything but that. But I'm grateful for that of all this. Now, it has set my softball season back, which I'm not happy about. You know, when I got incisions and stuff, and I can't really mess with that for a while. But really, the prognosis is good at this point. I'm just itching to get off of liquid food and eat something real. I haven't had solid food in 12 days. Yeah, 12 days. It's insane. Just insane. But I feel good. They do give you painkillers, you know, so in an emergency when you finally go, okay. You know, my problem with me is that it's a badge of honor to gut it out. And that's not the way it's supposed to work. You're supposed to actually use that stuff, aren't you?
Yeah, but.
But my feeling is I will deal with it until absolutely necessary. Now, for instance, last night I broke down because I thought, I got this show tomorrow. I'm not going to be fighting pain all night and then come in here and do this. So at any rate, I feel like I saw the soft underbelly of our medical system in both ways. One is the insurance that drove me to make decisions that led me to 9 days in the hospital, which is one area altogether. The second is watching the system work around me, how it worked and how it didn't. And I likened it as I was sitting in my hospital bed. I had some of the folks from the staff come up to me, how you doing, and got any observations. And I said, yeah, I got a bunch of them. And it was like, I said, your system here is like you're watching Lord of the Rings and those sequences where you're underground and you got all these caves and they're mining and they got all the wooden ladders and all the trolls and all the underworld people are running back and forth.
Did you just call your medical support staff trolls?
Yes, I did. And they're running back and forth and somehow it gets done. That is until the dwarves and the hobbits come in and wreak havoc, and then everything collapses in a heap. And I'm thinking, what does it take for this to collapse in a heap? Because there's so – I mean, I must have dealt with 50, 60 different people in different in three different beds on two different floors or actually one floor but two different areas. And they come and they go and – and basically, they get it right if they're paying attention to the charts and stuff. But you just wonder. And the other thing that's really fascinating, and there's nothing you can do about this, even in the medical system, is the different personalities.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You've got, you know, there's some people who were born to do this, and some people really should not be there. Even if they're technically good at what they do, when you're that vulnerable, you need to have a vibe coming at you that says, I care, I'm going to take care of you, this is going to all work out. And when the person doing that has some other agenda, regardless of what it is, it's disconcerting. Because here you are, you're doped up, you're drifting in and out, you're hallucinating, you got all these things. I swear to God, every time
Where was the bad part?
wait, all right.
And their stress comes through, and you're feeling their stress.
Right, and that's the other thing. When they're stressed out, you know, you pick up on that so quickly. And then you start to feel guilty of like, oh, I can't demand anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in agony here, but I'm not going to say anything because I did in the hospital. So All right,
the drugs. It was the drugs.
Yeah, that's enough of that.
By the way, I think that's the first time the Hobbit argument has ever been employed to argue for reform in the medical system. I just wanted to make that clear.
It's the Mike Novak Show on Q4 Radio, 1680 AM. And we're going to do the stuff we usually do. That's why we're here. That means that Patrick Barry is here with the Chicago Farm Report. Patrick, it's good to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning. Good to see you here sitting in the chair talking.
Yeah, I know, as opposed to the alternative, as we said. Oh, by the way, I have to give a shout-out to Rosa in Joliet with a sick peach tree. Bill was telling me to do this. And you know what? I know none of them are listening, but I'm going to give out a shout-out to the staff at Evanston Hospital because they really did take good care of me. And they're good people, and they work very hard. Those people work very, very hard. That's a tough job. I would never do that, not in a heartbeat. And so my thanks to them for seeing me through, getting me through. And I did my shout out to Rosa. So there we go. I'm fascinated, Patrick, by this story that you sent me from the New York Times about the Whole Foods effect on local growers. Explain what that's all about.
It's about supply and demand and trying to find some balance when demand goes up. And demand for local food has gone up dramatically, the New York Times story says, from consumers used to 13% of consumers in 2007 were interested in local food. Now it's 25% and growing.
Yeah. That's a quarter of the people shopping want their food sourced locally.
And so Whole Foods hires what they call local foragers who are going out looking for products made from local food or products made locally, food products made locally. And when that when they find one, that's the Whole Foods effect goes into create some trouble for that small company because all of a sudden they need to fill the shelves in 3 or 4 or 14 Whole Foods stores.
Yeah, and the story mentions this cheese operation in California that got approached by Whole Foods to ramp up dramatically, and so they invested all this money, and they built this new facility to age their cheese, and they didn't get the cultures in the room right, and the cheese went black, and this was fortunately Whole Foods was very patient and said, give it another shot, and they got it right. And as a result, they've become a pretty big operation.
That's right. And there are many other stories like that, including some in Chicago of companies. One guy I know, Jimmy, of Jimmy's Vegan Cookies, he has been promoting his cookies for years. He's into Whole Foods now, and he will be in the new Englewood store when that opens this fall. And that store, they're trying to have 25 local suppliers providing food to the store. That means Southsiders and Chicagoans. And so that's a lot of opportunity, but that also means they have to be able to ramp up. Jimmy had to find an industrial kitchen where he could cook make his cookies. He tried outsourcing it but wasn't successful with the various places he tried. So he's back to renting time in the kitchen and making its own cookies, which, of course, allows for the best quality control.
If you're interested in this, you can go to my website, mikenovak.net. On the right side of the page, it says read about this week's show. And I've got links to that article and other articles. Well, one of the things that was really kind of interesting, they point out some of those producers won't do it. They'll, you know, they get approached and they say, no, it's gonna ruin my product. I can't possibly do it in that kind of quantity. That's got to be really hard to turn down Whole Foods, yeah. Don't you think?
Yeah, I've talked to people at Good Food Festival about that same thing, and they say, I can't get that big.
Yeah.
I'll lose the essence of my product and why I went into business for myself.
Right. So at some point, some of those folks have to turn it down. And I also noticed that my old stomping grounds from when I was very young, Detroit area, they've got an incubator operation there, and I think in Southfield, that has meant, yes, a Hopeful Harvest, a food incubator that accelerates growth there. And that sounds like that. It says it was started 2 years ago by the local food pantry Forgotten Harvest when it noticed increased demand for commercial kitchen space and food processing facilities. It invested more than $200,000 to build out an empty warehouse with everything needed to manufacture food in bulk, including bottling lines, giant mixers, deep freezers. Hopeful Harvest was soon handling 3 shifts, 7 days a week.
Wow.
It works with 35 companies, has a waiting list, and plans to build a new facility by year's end. Unbelievable.
And here in Chicago, the Industrial Council of Near West Chicago runs the Fulton Carroll Incubator. It has about 120 companies in it. Many of them are food companies, and the demand there is similar. There's a need for more and better food processing facilities, which, of course, have to meet certain safety food safety standards.
Well, you know, several years ago, there was a big deal here in Chicago about the food kitchen on Milwaukee that was shut down repeatedly, and I covered that story, and it was unfair. But it was at a time of transition for food kitchens, open kitchens in Chicago. Shared kitchens is what I'm talking about. Now I'm going to blank on the woman's name who ran that. Do you remember? It might come to me. Check it out, Peggy. See if you can find that. But she would get inspected once a week. I mean, just crazy stuff.
I remember that. It was
yeah.
Crazy.
And finally, she just said, I'm done. I'm out of here. And I think things have changed since then. I think in the city of Chicago, they're a little more encouraging. But it was the old fiefdom, the old health department. They didn't know that the world was changing, that we needed these things. And they were, you know, the old restaurant model, which is, we'll go in and look for a rat and then and if we like you and you bribe us, we'll come.
We'll take it out of our bag.
Yeah, right.
That was the Logan Square Kitchen, I think.
Yeah, Logan Square Kitchen. Who ran that, though? And she's wonderful.
Zena?
Yes. Yes. Zena Murray. Okay. Yeah, Zena Murray. And she was on the show a number of times, and Monica Eng covered this story extensively. It was just a shame. Because she was paving the way, helping to pave the way, and she got crushed by the bureaucracy of the city of Chicago. I don't know. I got to get her on the show and see what she's doing now. But I bet she's landed on her feet because she was one tough woman, and I'm sure she's doing fine. But that's a follow up for me. All right, so that's the Whole Foods effect. But you're also talking about. In the Farm Report this week, Patrick Berry, the Frontera Farmer Foundation, which has awarded 18 local sustainable farmers. What's going on?
Right. So if you step one step back from the food kitchens, you have the food producers, and they have the same challenge. How do you ramp up your food production on a farm so that you can meet this demand, so that you can provide to a market or to a restaurant or to a wholesaler the quantities of food they need because of this demand for local food. Frontera, Rick Bayless and Deanne Bayless and the staffs of their restaurants started this Frontera Farmer Foundation, and they've given almost $2 million to small farmers over the years since 2003 so that those farmers can make really small but important purchases of mostly equipment and supplies so they can ramp up their business.
Yeah, and they've even pointed out in your story that you wrote a story about this for Chicago Farm Report. It really does change their lives. It puts them ahead, like 10 years ahead of the game.
Right, Greta Winkelbauer. She's got Greta's Goats in Pecatonica, Illinois. She at the Glenwood Sunday Market where we shop. We can buy Greta's goat milk soap. But that's a dry product that doesn't require refrigeration and safety all the way up from the farm. She wanted to get into dairy. A year ago, the foundation provided a small grant. These grants are up to $12,000 to start building out her dairy. And this year's grant allowed her to build a, what she's calling a mobile milking parlor. That's a that's a utility.
I've wanted one of those.
I know.
For decades.
I want one too after I read about it because and she told me all the nitty gritty details. It's a 7x12 utility trailer that she tows out to the field where her goats are in pasture. So these are your free range goats.
And these are not your mother's goats either, right?
Right. And then she milks the goats in the field. She has hand washing station and all that there.
Yeah.
And then she brings the milk back to the dairy operation, makes it into cheese. She's just starting this now, but she hopes to bring that cheese to Chicago in this fall.
How cool is that? So that's one of the things I like about Bayless is that he is a guy who's become very successful at what he does, and his payback is just as important to him. I've seen him speak a number of times, and he's an impressive guy.
Yeah, and what he wants to do is he wants to build up a whole army of suppliers that are thinking about providing good food and getting it to either restaurants or retailers or whatever very quickly.
Yeah. And this wraps around that first story as well, in that 10 years ago, I had this conversation 10 years ago, maybe not quite that long. I had a conversation. Somebody was interviewing me about food stuff. And, I'm not the biggest expert in the world. I'm a reporter, like you are in a sense. But the question posed to me was, can we feed the world this way? And I said, well, we have to in some respect. Because the conventional, I'm using my air quotes here, conventional farmers say you can't feed it any other way but with the chemicals and the tilling and whatever else goes on, although they're moving away from some of those things. And yet, if you look at this movement, when Whole Foods gets behind local growers and sustainability, and Rick Bayless is pumping money into it, that's changing the dynamic. I mean, when you're getting up to 15, 25% of your demand coming for those kinds of products, we are changing the world. And it is, and the kind of food we eat is very different from, at least the options are different from what they were 10, 15 years ago. Wouldn't you agree?
I would. So here's another example is Midnight Sun Farm. It's in Harvard, Illinois. That's Nick Batchelder and his wife, Becky Stark. They're onion specialists, so they grow some great onions. We've bought them and eaten them. But they had a small farm a couple of years ago. They needed to try to ramp up to meet this demand, so they got a 50-acre site in Harvard, Illinois. You go up from 3 acres to 50 acres, you can't hand plant anymore. You can't,
right.
You can't do it the same way you did in the small intensive. So their grant from Frontera is for a automated seedling transplanter. So that thing automatically sticks the seedling into the ground for you. And Nick said a nice straight even row.
Uh-huh.
A tine cultivator so they can drag it behind the tractor and do the weeding instead of doing
And it points out just because you're local and small doesn't mean you can't use automation.
Oh, and one of the biggest CSA farms around, I think one of the biggest in the nation really, Angelic Organics, on their Facebook page, they have some pictures of their automation. They fill 1,400 boxes a week with food for their community-supported agriculture program. They have a potato harvester that's a wonder to observe,
uh-huh.
and other things like that. So, yes, automation and efficient practices is going to be part of how you meet the local foods effect.
You know, last week, Peggy, when you were talking to the folks from Angelic Organics, Kathleen Bolin, and I listened to the show afterward, that part of it because the cardiologist was in the room. I wanted to yell, hey, I've been out there. Farmer John rode me around in his pickup truck on that. I mean, it was a bumpy ride. That guy is a treat. He is,
He's a showman.
He, right.
He's amazing.
That's the thing, and that's how he's made part. That's part of how he's made it work. Is he understands the value of entertainment, of keeping people engaged. He's an artist. I mean, if you've seen the documentary "The Dirt on the Real Farmer John," you know what we're talking about. He's a trip.
Yeah, at the cover of his cookbook, Farmer John cookbook. He's got this boa on, and crazy shorts.
Right, right. He's a very funny guy. So,
but you remember it, and you remember the small farm and the experience.
Yeah.
It's not just going to the store and buying something in the produce department.
Right. Right.
And I think he's an innovator. Of course, they're using organic practices, but they're demonstrating that, yes, you can feed the world with organic. And there are a lot of these small farmers out there. They're very creative. They're learning, in effect, a new way. I mean, it's the old way of doing farming, but they're learning it again.
Yeah.
And I think by telling the stories, by sharing amongst themselves, which they do constantly, that's how we will be able to feed the world with new style of agriculture.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, so where are you seeing this going in the next 3 to 5 years? We were saying 10 years ago we wouldn't have imagined this. Where is this going?
Well, just the Frontera grants alone. So 18 different farmers are getting, let's say they're getting hoop houses, they're getting new equipment for their tractors or whatever. They're ramping up their capacity. In 3 to 5 years, they're going to know a whole lot more than they know now about how to use that kind of equipment, how to extend their season. And they're also probably going to continue to grow. So what I think is happening is the small farms are starting to take some of the corn and soybeans out of production and turn that back into what they would call interim sustainable agriculture before it's certified.
Specialty crops.
And they're specialty crops. And
specialty crops.
That, which is, for those not in the know of USDA lingo, that means fruits and vegetables, the stuff that we should be eating every day.
I know. It makes me crazy. The Food to Market Challenge. That's $500,000 to a team that can design an innovative solution to reconceive supply chain practices? What's that about?
Well, that's about the same thing, supply and demand. There's a recognized lack of ability to meet demand in Chicago with local food. The farmers say it. The foundations are starting to understand that. Rick Bayless says it. And Whole Foods is saying it. So how do you address that? One of the problems is it's a logistics challenge. How do you get, first of all, how do you grow the food in quantity? And then how do you get it to market in quantity? That's what the Food to Market Challenge is. The Searle Funds at the Chicago Community Trust is behind this food land opportunity is the operation that's giving out these grants. And this is a single winner-take-all competition.
But it's not just one person. You need to have various elements to this.
Right. The deadline for registering is next Tuesday. Most of the groups have already registered.
Meaning this coming Tuesday, meaning today's the 24th, the 26th, right?
Writing, yes.
Correct. But then they have until May 10th to finalize their proposal. And each, it's a team thing. It has to have a farmer on it within 250 miles of Chicago. And it can have any other types of entrepreneurs, nonprofits, businesses. The hope is that these groups will, by working together and by putting together their heads from different sectors, come up with something that will say, yeah, we can bring in more food. And we're going to do it in the following way. I think it's going to be a logistics, trucking consolidation thing where you're bringing a lot of food into what they call a food hub of some sort, and then you're bringing it into the markets and distributing it into the markets.
Have you thought about entering this yourself?
I did think about it, but I couldn't write about it the same way if I was an
a contestant.
Contestant, and I wouldn't. I'm not a farmer or.
Yeah, but you enlist a farmer to be on your team.
Well, I'm not entering it. I've been told that
you don't need the $500,000.
I've been told that they have a great teams have already entered, and the dialogue already is very stimulating. So it sounds like they've got some very good ideas in the works.
Well, if anybody's listening to that and they say, "Oh yeah, I've got a great idea. I've been thinking about this for years." And you've got till Tuesday just to get the basics across so that you can get to the May 10th deadline.
Right. You get into the system by Tuesday, and then there will be other people already registered who are looking for team members. So teams are still being assembled. So if you're interested, if you think you could contribute to a team, you register and then you find out what teams are out there.
And you can find that out at food2marketchallenge.org. That link is on my website, mikenovak.net. Again, if you're looking for the write-up, I do a write-up every week about the show ahead of time so that if you're listening along, you can follow along and click on some of these links. And on the homepage, mikenovak.net, on the right upper right side, it says Listen Now. And right below that, Read About This Week's Show. And that's where you read about this week's show.
And I've got the links up on Facebook, too.
You got the links on Facebook, on the Mike Novak Show on Facebook, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
You're very efficient.
She's good. I got to tell you something. I learned something while I was in the hospital is that Peggy is organized, okay? This woman is organized. But then you couldn't run Natural Awakenings magazine, Chicago, without being organized. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in that magazine.
Lots of moving parts.
Yeah, really. I know, Patrick, you also wanted to talk about plant sales, and there's a lot going on. Is there anyone in particular you want to mention before we get out of here?
Only that one place to buy seedlings instead of the big box store is from the farms themselves. The Talking Farm in Skokie is one of them. There's a bunch of other farms listed, and some of them do drop-offs at various places in the western suburbs, for instance, Sweet Home Organics. So there's ways of buying your seedlings direct from a grower, in some cases organic grower, in the Chicago area.
Right, and the place to find that is at chicagofarmreport.com, because I saw the article. You've put articles about there about those plant sales. You know, and this is the time of year, and folks go, yeah, I got to get those. Mm-hmm. You know, because not everybody grows from seed. I totally understand that. Although at home we have some of the prettiest little tomatoes that we grew. They are just so nice. I'm so excited that we grew from seed. But the rest of my plants pretty much this year, well, until we get into summer, and then all my warm season veggies are going to be from seed. But I didn't get the cool season started, so I'm getting starter plants. I got LaManda Joy. Hey, LaManda! To pick me up some plants at Peterson Garden Project, because I said, oh, I'm so sick. I can't get over there. Eric and Kathy in Evanston want to know where to find and how to plant asparagus. Oh, my God, that's like a whole seminar. Jessica Fuyan is nodding there in the back. Oh, my goodness, yes. I'll tell you what, that I'm going to save that. Do you have asparagus?
We don't, and you have to start early. It's starting to come up now, so it's too late for this year. Anyway.
And you got to wait 3 years to be able to harvest it. So what we'll do, that's on the list. I got to do an asparagus seminar here because it's not the – it's kind of an unusual one.
It's tricky.
Yeah, it's a little tricky.
One of the things in our household, we think, hey, we could try to grow asparagus, but why grow it when we got some excellent growers out there and we can buy it at the farmer's market for months?
Yeah. So Eric and Kathy, I'm glad you get you stopped. You know, on the weekdays they do the radio show, and now they're listening to my program. Isn't that just awesome?
Yes. So I had one thing for plant sales. I was talking to somebody from Peterson Garden Project yesterday, and they mentioned the same thing that I notice all the time at plant sales. Bring a box or something to carry it in, because most places
good point.
Don't have anything.
That's right. And that is, as you wrote, I think, the other day, plant etiquette. It's let's bring your own box and don't make them provide that kind of stuff, because we got enough junk in the world. Reuse something. You know, that's one of the things I like about Costco. It's like, okay, yeah, we'll throw you half a box that is there, but I still bring my own bags, you know. So.
And I can always go in my basement and find bags and boxes, so I'm sure I'm not alone.
Patrick Barry, Chicago Farm Report. I'm so glad you're part of the program these days.
I'm glad to be part of the program. It's a different way of thinking about stuff, and it helps me generate stories, too.
Fabulous. And you can always go to ChicagoFarmReport.com, also on Facebook, Chicago Farm Report. It actually pops up pretty quickly. You don't have a lot of competition in that regard, and that's because there's so much going on. Nobody actually wants to have to deal with all of it. Am I right?
I guess so.
Okay, it's the Mike Novak Show on Q4 Radio 1680 AM. Short break, and then Jessica Fuyen from Food and Water Watch is coming up next. Your phone calls are always welcome. 312-985-7834.
Spending more time at home these days? Give yourself some room. Renovate your basement or attic. You'll increase your living space and your home's resale value, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling needs, including additions, renovations, and other home improvements. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
My buddy Mike Novak works for an outfit that is trying to take over the country, but in a good way. Here's what I mean. He writes a column for Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, and that magazine is published by the same folks who publish magazines in 21 states, from Minnesota to Florida, from Pennsylvania to Oklahoma. They're called State by State Gardening, and in most of the Midwest and the South, you can get your hands on a magazine that is going to teach you a lot about gardening in your own state. These great publications feature articles by some of the leading gardening experts in each state, including famous authors, nursery owners, state extension agents, master gardeners, and even Mike. Well, you can't hit a home run in every at-bat. And who knows, if your state doesn't have a state-by-state gardening magazine, they might very soon. Subscribe today by going to statebystategardening.com or call 888-265-3600. That's 888-265-3600.
It's not just your garden. It's the way you live. And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow. With Bonnie.
Hey, this is Peggy. When I speak at local events, people often ask me, aren't you the Peggy in the Natural Awakenings ads? And that makes me happy because it reminds me that Chicagoans want to live healthier lives, and Natural Awakenings magazine helps them do just that. Natural Awakenings, it's the greenest, healthiest magazine in the Chicago area. Each month, we bring you the latest information about health and wellness, complementary medicine, fitness and exercise, raising healthy kids, and even healthy pets. You'll find articles about healthy homes, too, including gardening, energy efficiency, and green living. And if you love good food, you'll always find tasty recipes and cooking hints. Check out our monthly calendar. It's full of events to help keep you connected. Natural Awakenings is available in more than 1,100 locations throughout Chicago and suburban Cook, Lake, and McHenry counties. And it's free. Or visit us online at nachicagonorth.com. Natural Awakenings. Feel good. Live simply. Laugh more.
The dog days are over, the dog days are done, the horses are coming, so you better run. Run fast for your mother, run fast for your father, run for your children, for your sisters and brothers. Leave all your loving behind, you can't carry it with you if you want to survive. The dog days are over.
Oh. I figure anytime you get out of the hospital, the dog days are over. Yikes. And everybody's jamming here, which is just the way I want it. You know, and we got right into the segment, and there I was just doing my little own, very own pity party. Excuse me. And I forgot to mention the rest of the show. We just said Jessica Fuyen from Food and Water Watch is here now. At 10 a.m., Nick Fuller, who is the owner and principal ecologist with Natural Communities Native Plants, and I ding them because if you've been listening, they're a new sponsor on the Mike Novak Show for the last several weeks. And he's going to be here with Keith Novakowski, who's a landscape architect and author of Native Plants in the Home Landscape for the Upper Midwest. He's been on the show, but not for a long, long time, and there's a copy of the book right there. which we might actually give away. I'm not sure how we would do that. Because folks could use that. And the whole idea is, in that segment is we're going to talk about demystifying native plants, because we talk all the time. People go, well, you should plant natives in your backyard. And then people's eyes glaze over. Well, what do you mean? What's a native? What am I? I don't know what you're talking about, because I go to the store and it's not necessarily the plants that were in the Midwest when the settlers got here. So we'll do that. And Rick DeMaio Weather, 1045, he sent me a nice note last night welcoming me back. So I'm very happy to talk to him. And speaking of natural communities, you're a gardener, and you've heard over and over again about how important it is to help our pollinators by putting native plants in the yard, and yet you haven't really figured out how to make the switch. It's a little intimidating, right? You can never find the plants that you want, and you'd like some advice to go with those little blue stems, wouldn't you? Fear no more. Natural Communities native plants are here, and you can get them online at naturalcommunities.net. Natural Communities native plants are locally grown and sourced, featuring more than 150 species native to the Chicago region. They have convenient online shopping and mail delivery, but they also appear at local green events where you can get those questions answered. Garden with plants that have thousands of years of natural design behind them and that have been working for thousands of years with our local pollinators and other fauna. Garden with native plants. And in Chicagoland, the way to do that is with Natural Communities native plants. Go to naturalcommunities.net. It's the Mike Novak Show on Q4 Radio 1680 AM, but if you're listening to it, it's probably at www.que4.org. And in the studio, and I'm so happy to see you again, Jessica Fuyan from Food and Water Watch. Hi, Jessica.
Hey, Mike. It's great to be here.
It was Peggy who made me aware of one of the initiatives. And you guys at Food, explain about Food and Water Watch, because you hear you guys on different programs, but you cover a lot of different areas, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Food and water encompasses quite a bit. Some of our most essential resources are our food and water, and there are a lot of ways to protect them and to mess them up.
and mess them up, that's a really good point.
That's a technical term.
Yeah, and we do that pretty well.
We do. But at Food and Water Watch, we are lucky to team up with thousands of Illinoisans and people across the country to protect those resources and to hold our elected officials and other appointed officials accountable for making sure they're working in our favor. So Food and Water Watch is national. We have international offices as well. We work primarily on legislative or regulatory measures to keep our most essential resources in check, and we do that through grassroots organizing. So we pair up with grassroots organizations, with individual people, with some grass tops members as well, and we take on hard issues with the best solutions we can muster.
Well, and one of the
Peggy. I was going to say, what is a grass top member?
Oh, I would say the grass tops maybe are the bigger green groups that you might have heard of, like the Sierra Club or 350.com.
I've never heard that phrase.
I know grassroots, but grass tops, that was new. Yeah.
I don't think I coined it, but I'll take credit.
Does she get a ding for that?
Yes, okay, all right.
Oh, wow.
And something that I saw that I kind of knew in the back of my head, but is worth repeating so that everybody knows the kind of pressure that is out there. You know, right now, under the radar, is this idea of water privatization. Mm-hmm. It raises its head for a while. There's, these companies put these trial balloons out. They approach legislatures. They go, let's see what we can get away with. Let's see how we can make inroads into this idea. And then they go back, the whack-a-mole thing. They go back under the ground. But as you point out, in the past four sessions, the Illinois legislature has sponsored bills that would challenge our rights to defend our water or force ratepayers to foot the bill for risky acquisitions, meaning that privatization has appeared in the last four sessions in Springfield. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows this. Nobody's paying attention to that. Well, not nobody. You guys are, obviously. The average citizen isn't. They're more concerned about pensions and about schools and about Rauner's, back to 1890s agenda. And yet, those big companies are out there saying, we want to control the water supply.
Yeah, and actually there have been some water privatization measures introduced in the current session on, I guess, the flip side. And so there is actually a Republican legislator in the Peoria area who is working to defend public water. And we'd like to see more of that and maybe even introduce some legislation ourselves to protect public water. But I think your point is an excellent one. People are very concerned about the budget, and they really easily forget that one of the things tied up in that budget is infrastructure maintenance. And that our water utilities were created hundreds of years ago in some cases.
Right.
And need maintenance very badly. And a lot of, struggling municipalities have allowed that infrastructure to fall into repair. Disrepair, I'm sorry. And if we don't figure out a budgetary solution to that, we're going to see, I guess, an even more aggressive push by private companies to take over those utilities.
Yeah, and that's the whole point, is that the argument that's going to be made is, we can't afford it. We can't afford infrastructure. We can't afford to have our – in that regard, we can't afford anything. All right, let's face it. If you're going to go down that road, why not just hand a gun out to everybody and say, see you later, there's no need for civilization? Because we can't afford – that's our whole – that seems to be the mantra now among various municipalities and governments, is that we can't afford anything, so why bother?
Yeah, and I think one of the things – that people aren't nearly as aware of is that it's a lot cheaper actually for municipalities to raise the money that they need to either maintain or to repair a water utility. So municipal bonds are actually a lot cheaper and get better interest rates than corporate bonds do. So not only do corporations receive a worse rate, but then they also need to turn a profit to keep their shareholders happy. So when we think about the rate increases that we're facing in cities like Chicago, for instance, we will end up having to pay a little bit more for our water to ensure that it comes to us safe and clean. However, if we allow a private company to do the same repair or the same administration, it will be considerably more costly.
And the Trojan horse for all of this, as I see it right now, and I could be wrong about this, is lead in the water supply. Mm-hmm. Now that's the big scare. So these companies come and say, we will protect you from lead. We will protect your kids. We're the only ones that can afford to do this right. So you should trust us. And my feeling is, really? I'm going to trust the corporation to decide who gets clean pipes and who does not get clean pipes. But people don't think rationally when it comes to those. They say, yeah, we need somebody to protect us. We need people. These companies can afford it because they've got stockholders and they've got the money and they've got the capital, and we can get this done and we can get our pipes fixed.
Yeah, I think that there are two major problems with this, and primarily one is that we elect our governments and we elect our municipal officials, and we hold them accountable by either re-electing them or voting them out of office, and we don't have that luxury with a corporation. Mm-hmm. And so if we look to corporations to do things like repair our lead service lines and they are not providing adequate service, if people are left without water for long periods of time, if the construction efforts are more costly than they initially anticipate, then we have really no recourse. And what we have guaranteed them is a profit, and that comes out of our pockets.
You know, it's interesting. I started the show with did you see this Last Week Tonight with John Oliver?
No.
He did a thing on lead, okay? And the idea that we got rid of lead in our paints and lead in our gasoline in the 70s and early 80s. In Europe, they'd done it in the 20s, okay? And here, this is the way America works. It's like, well, we can't interrupt capitalism, free enterprise. How dare we do that? And yet, here we are. There we were, and one of the women, a person quoted in this segment he did, said, our children are not going to get poisoned by lead in the water. They're getting poisoned by lead in the paint. Which is really true. There's a lot of it. I mean, my own house is 125 years old and is coated with lead-based paint. Good thing I don't eat that. I'm tempted to this week because I have no solid foods. But But there's danger all around us is what the point is. And we have to hold, you know, it's hard enough to hold our governments accountable. It's even harder to hold a private corporation accountable. And I think that's one of the points you're making there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so here in Chicago, I think there's a massive effort. There's a massive effort to do more research on whether or not the lead service pipes in our city are impacting the youth. So right now it's predicted that about 80% or 400,000 of the service pipes that are in Chicago communities are made of lead.
I'm sure I've got one going into my house that's made of lead.
Me too.
Yeah.
My house is almost
certainly. Even if they change the street, it's still the feed going into your house.
Right, and
no
the point is
don't
do what they did in Flint, mm-hmm. which is disturb it at the moment until we can figure out the way to systematically remove and replace those pipes. If you leave them, really they're not going to cause that much trouble. Although, you know, if you look at, you know, since this thing happened in Flint, and actually before that, folks have been doing studies about lead in the water, and there's lots of hot spots all over the United mm-hmm. States. It's not just Flint.
Right, and the EPA actually called on cities and states in the recent past to start releasing that information, the locations of the lead service pipes and the concentrations, I guess, of lead pipes. And states are really reticent to do it. You know, they don't want the general public to have that information. And I think that we're standing kind of at the gates of a really important time in the way that we manage our water. And I guess one thing that I would love to highlight about Flint specifically is that Flint previously got its water from the Detroit water system.
Right.
As many people know, Detroit is being bankrupted in a number of ways.
Right.
And
so it can be taken over and privatized.
Right, exactly. There are many people who opine that the Flint removal from the Detroit water source was kind of a blow. When you take away 10% of the service area of the Detroit water system, it creates the opportunity for private companies to take that system over. And I think that as we're watching the system or the situation unfold here in Chicago, we need to be aware of the fact that protecting our public water system is of the utmost importance, and it's something we should all be watching for.
Peggy brought up something. She found something. You go ahead. This is you. You found this, so let me know about this.
Well, I'm hoping you can fill in a little bit more information as well, Jessica, but I just got an invitation for the Northeastern Illinois Water Supply Forum, Thursday, May 12th, which is the Northwest Water Planning Alliance and Metropolitan Planning Council for an interactive discussion before there is a crisis on water supplies in the area.
Mm-hmm.
What? Proactive?
Wow.
What? Are you kidding me? What's that all about?
Of course, it is sponsored by the major – no. It's not.
And even if it were. So I think this is especially important because it isn't typically cities like Chicago and Detroit that are targeted primarily for water privatization by companies. It's smaller municipalities, especially ones with either low budgets or crumbling infrastructure. And so in the collar counties, there are a lot of opportunities for private companies to start preying mm-hmm. on these smaller villages and towns. And I think that
sorry to interrupt, but you're right, because a lot of the smaller towns, you see this all the time. Like, okay, I'll use, for example, LaSalle County, which opened its doors to frac sand mining because we're going to make money. It's going to bring revenue into the – never mind that it's going to destroy the quality of life. But a lot of the smaller towns, they have these very small boards. They're easily swayed. And suddenly you got this little town and it's sold out and suddenly it's privatized. And that's one of the ways it'll sneak up. And as Bill Turk sent me a little note here about, talking about Bruce Rauner. One of the theories is that he wants to bankrupt Illinois government to drive privatization. It wouldn't surprise me a bit that's the agenda. That's the real agenda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that this forum is especially important right now because the people being called to this forum are elected officials, municipal governments. There will be some industry representation, and then members of the EPA, so appointed agencies as well. And I can tell you that I wasn't invited to the forum. However, I think it's really important for organizations.
You guys are too radical.
I didn't say it.
I said it. I'm the radio guy.
You're the radio guy.
You're, wait. So if there's the green, the grassroots, and the grass tops. Where does that put you, you know, at Food and Water Watch?
You know, we're a little bit in the middle. We're a grassroots organizing entity. We work with the people, and I think that we've shown time and time again that it's only by mobilizing the grassroots mm-hmm. that we can move important policy through the legislature. It's not, you know, our relationships with legislators. It's our relationships with voters and the population that make our work possible and successful. And in this case, I think that it's really important for there to be more either private citizens or grassroots organizations present at a forum like this to get the information they need to show elected officials that people are interested and to, you know, push back on the idea that the industry knows best what we should be doing with our municipal water utilities.
Well, we got a petition that folks can sign there, right, Peggy?
Yeah, there's a petition for clean drinking water for all that Food and Water Watch has posted on their website. If you go to foodandwaterwatch.org and there's a Get Involved button you can click on, and it's a petition that goes to various legislators. It asks where you're located. I presume so it routes it appropriately. Mm-hmm. It's easy petition to just fill it out, sign your name. It is pre-written for you, or you can customize it as well.
Well, Jessica Fuyen, Food and Water Watch. And of course, folks want more information, they could go to foodandwaterwatch.org.
Org. And we hope that you'll take a look, because there's a lot of information about Illinois, specifically about some of the cities in Illinois that have chosen to privatize, and a lot of those who have fought back.
How many cities have privatized?
So I don't know the total number. It's very large. Unfortunately, I don't
really?
Know.
Really? It's not just a creeping thing. It's already happening.
Oh, dozens, yes. And I believe in the last 6 years, seven cities have privatized, although that might be inaccurate because just 2 days ago another city privatized to save $5 on 5,500 gallons of water.
Are you kidding me?
It wasn't even a financial necessity. They were just trying to save a little bit of money.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think this is a reflection of the fact that people aren't always aware of what they stand
to lose.
No,
they don't pay attention to their local politics is one of the things. It's that you got the folks yelling at each other about Trump and Hillary and Bernie and Cruz, and they have no clue what's happening at city council.
Well, and to be fair, I think a lot of times industry comes in with a really persuasive pitch to a very small town. You know, oftentimes they're towns of between 500 and 5,000 people. And we don't spend a lot of time in the United States talking about where our water mm-hmm. comes from or what we stand to lose by selling it.
And it's our most – I can't imagine a more precious resource than water. Most important thing we're talking about, the idea of access – to clean water. I do a garden talk, and I show the globe, the earth, and it's been stripped of its water. And you can see the earth and the seas drained of the water, and there's a globe, which is a dry globe, and there's this little globe right next to it, and it's tiny, tiny little globe. And it shows the water from the seas compared to, you know, we think of the oceans 5 miles deep and, wow, that's a lot. That's just the skin of the earth, all right? So there's this little thing of water, little globe next to it. Next to that is a little pinpoint. That's the potable water on the earth, which is about 1% of what we have on the planet. And if we start putting it in the hands of people who are going to make a profit out of it, like we've put in America our health insurance in the hands of people who are going to make profit out of it, we are immoral. We have lost our way. And yet, as you point out, it's already happening. Mm-hmm. So we need to be vigilant.
We do need to be vigilant, and we need to recognize that people are fighting back. There are in O'Fallon, Illinois, in Mount Vernon, Illinois, last year, we worked with communities who held referendum votes and voted the private water companies out of their cities. And here in Illinois, I think we have an opportunity to make a legislative bid, too, to ensure that people have a right to hear about the sale before it happens and to cast their vote and represent themselves against giant private water companies, some of the biggest companies in the world.
Well, thank you so much for coming by. It's always, you're always welcome.
Oh, thank
always
you.
Always welcome on the program. Yes, sir, Mr. Turk.
I just wanted to make one quick point. You guys, when you guys were talking about elections and privatization and these small municipalities, that's where the Republicans and conservatives are concentrating their energy in elections here in the state of Illinois. And the Democrats or progressives are losing that fight or sometimes not even getting into that fight. And we need to pay more attention to those local elections. That's key.
Particularly well, that's been the case now for a dozen years
yes.
or more. And that's where... right, the conservatives have won hands down. They go charging into the local, and then they take over the states. And then you can win all the presidents you want, but if each state is controlled locally by forces that are in favor of this kind of move, privatization, how are you going to win? So the fight is always on. It's the Mike Novak Show on Q4 Radio, 1680 AM. And by the way, did you know that Genesis... and they're right in this very building where we broadcast, is the Midwest's largest source of airbrush supplies. Find out more at ChicagoAirbrushSupply.com or ArtSupply.com. Stop in their showroom at 2525 North Elston and say that you heard about them on the Mike Novak Show or on Q4 Radio and get an extra 10% off their already discounted prices all month long. Genesis, Chicago's only privately owned art supplier, serving all of Chicago's artistic framing and drafting needs since 1946. We will be back.
Captain's log, starting 42326.1. The Enterprise is under attack by an apparently hostile life form. Mr. Worf, status report.
Inexplicable, Captain. They appear to be perambulating vegetables. We are being stalked by stalks of asparagus.
That is incorrect, Mr. Worf. Killer asparagus was the subject of a very popular 21st century tome by the brilliant author Mike Novak.
Mike Novak. I'm familiar with his work, and so am I.
Mike Novak was one of the smartest, funniest people in the horticultural world of the 21st century.
Tell me more, Mr. Data.
He has been variously compared to Mark Twain, Dave Barry, and Edgar Allan Poe.
Raven Gosplach, my favorite holiday dish.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Mr. Data, options?
It seems to be available online at aroundtheblockpress.com.
Aroundtheblockpress.com. What do they have to say?
It appears that Mike Novak is a slapstick every gardener.
I prefer my asparagus with a side of patak-kakak.
Mr. Wolf, are you joking?
Actually, Captain, I believe he is choking.
Welcome back to the Mike Novak Show, still Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program. Broadcasting live every Sunday from the Genesis Art Supply Building on North Elston Avenue on Q4 Radio and at MikeNovak.net. Here he is again, Mike Novak.
Everybody sing along. Welcome back to the second hour. And I'm holding up. If you hear this sort of like that, it means that my head has fallen right into the beer dinger. And you'll have to kind of drag me out of the seat here. But I think the adrenaline has kicked in. So that's keeping me going. And Peggy Malecki from Natural Awakening Chicago magazine is here beside me. Bill Turk's in the studio, and a couple of people that I'm very eager to have on the program are here with me now, one of whom I've known for a while, and that's Keith Nowakowski, landscape architect and author of the book. And we have a copy here. We haven't decided if we're gonna give it away. Would love to do that. Native Plants in the Home Landscape for the Upper Midwest. And Nick Fuller, now I get it. You get a ding because you're with Natural Communities Native Plants, and he and I recently met because he's trying to change the culture of how people acquire their native plants. And as a matter of fact, why don't we start with you, Nick? Because that is something that folks, if you're going to a box store. You're going to be really lucky to find something that is a name. I mean, you can find them. They're there, but the palette's going to be really limited. It's kind of catch-as-catch-can. What's the problem you saw, and how do you address, or how are you addressing it?
Well, in the big box stores, their selection is really limited. First of all, as far as native species go, you don't know what it's been treated with, as far as pesticides and herbicides.
Wait. So let's stop right there. So here we are. You're buying a plant because it's native and you want it to grow well and be helpful to our pollinators, but it might have been treated. They treat native plants as well.
I would say it's unknown because when you get into like really large scale commercial production, mm-hmm. I think they're more proactive in treating plants. You know, it's because they're trying to get 100% purely aesthetic plants. So like zero holes in the leaves from things eating them, stuff
right,
like that. So
right.
they're trying mm-hmm. to show up looking perfect. So, I would say that there's a great potential that they have been treated with some sort of pesticide to treat for insects.
All right. So that's the first thing. And then limited, numbers of plants and the variety. So you saw this need and what did you do?
I started a company about 2.5 years ago to sell native plants. I wanted to get a bigger selection, so we have about 150 species. I saw that there was this big gap in the Chicago area, you know, even southern Illinois, pretty much all the surrounding states, that there's only a couple places to get native plants, and especially like in the Chicago area, to get locally sourced native plants. And so I made an internet company. Largely where you go on the website, you can order plants, have them shipped to you, you can pick them up. We also help a couple local native plant sales and run those for some local conservation agencies as well.
And you raise a very interesting point. I'm going to turn this over to Keith. You pull that microphone over now. Keith Nowakowski, he talks about locally sourced. How important is it to have really in terms of native plants, I think the purists say we got to have a plant that actually grew within 100-150 mile radius of where you live, because you can go out and buy a plant. Okay, I'm going to take Osage orange, for example. It's native, but it's native to Oklahoma,
right.
and that area. It's not necessarily – it'll grow in Illinois, and they were used for hedgerows
right.
here
right.
in Illinois. But if you buy it as a – you can buy it as a native, but it's not – it's native to North America. But that's not the same as being native to the Chicago region, right?
Right. And you just need to look at what you want to get out of the plant. Like the Osage orange was a agricultural plant, like you said, used for hedges before the days of barbed wire. It was a cheap replacement out on the prairie. You didn't have trees. So you
come in just a little closer.
So you used Osage orange. But I've used North American native plants. There's a blue mist flower that's more native to Oklahoma and Texas. It's a eupatorium, has a pretty blue flower in late summer. Looks great with the other asters that are blooming and the sunflowers in late summer. It's not native to northern Illinois, but pollinators like it. So, you know, there's room for whatever plant might do well in your particular situation. Your yard might be more difficult and you might have a limited palette of plants that to choose from.
So are you a purist about that, Keith? That, do you want it all within 150-mile radius, or are you happy when folks go a little bit farther stream?
When I grow a lot of my plants from seed, and for me it's the fun part is going to a railroad right-of-ways or little prairie remnants that aren't necessarily managed but have the prairie plants still existing. The oak trees in my yard I started from acorns collected on my parents' property. So for me it's meaningful in that way. But it's not important to necessarily to the butterflies where that milkweed plant came from. So it might be different if you're doing a restoration. Something might even be critical in that situation. But for a garden, someone's yard, which is what I usually deal with, it's not as important.
And that's the other good point. That's why you're both here, is that I know, Keith, that you've specialized in going to people's homes and looking at the site and not saying, well, we're gonna make a wholesale change and we'll create a prairie here. You look at the site and go, what's going to work here? You know, because there's an incredible variety. People think native plants, and I think all they think about is a prairie. But there's so much more than that, isn't there?
Right. You can think about shrubs as well, the hydrangea, smooth hydrangea. Serviceberry is a great plant that will grow in
Mine's in bloom right now.
Yeah, mine is just finishing and beautiful white flowers in spring. great edible small fruit, look like blueberries, taste like plums in June. Then great fall color, and it can take a little bit of shades. For an urban situation, it's great, very tough, and it's native to the shores of Lake Michigan, so it's perfectly hardy for our area.
And I think that's one place, and Nick, I'm going to ask you, that gets a little neglected, and that is the shrubs. And I know you've worked with Possibility Place in Moni, and it's time for me to have either Connor Shaw or Kelsey Shaw on the program again, because Connor, of course, is Connor. And I call him my nemesis because he shows up at conferences when I'm speaking and sits in the back of the room or sometimes in the front of the room and, you know, folds his arms and waits for me to say something stupid. So, but I love the guy. You work with shrubs as well, right, Nick?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And one thing that Keith had just mentioned was like some of the edible berries too, and nuts on a lot of this, a lot of the native plants. That's also like a really cool crossover with permaculture, because it's kind of performing natural resource and food source for your family. Because the service berries, like at my house, when it would produce the berries, we actually went out, collected them, grabbed like 5-gallon buckets off of it, froze them, we ate them. My daughter loved them, so. It was, and they're pretty, you know. So
I love service berries.
Yeah, that's one of
now,
my favorites.
Now, I can't eat them out of my yard because the birds get them first. And it's very interesting. I was judging a garden contest in Lakeview, Sheffield Garden Walk. I'm going to say 8-9 years ago. And we were walking down the street, and there were these service berries, and they were chock full of the berries. So I'm starting to pick and I'm eating and I'm really enjoying them. And I said, now how come mine are stripped in my yard, but here there's the birds have just left them? I don't understand. You have any idea why that might be?
No, I've noticed the same thing though. When I was going to school in Urbana at the local mall, they had service berry growing in their beds, and they were loaded with fruit. And
I hope it wasn't because they were sprayed or anything.
Well, yeah, I had a few and they seemed fine, but the birds, the robins will come, even squirrels will, you know, for better or worse, come and get them.
Yeah.
But
do you think it's maybe something from the soil that's affecting the flavor?
I sometimes wonder if there's, you know, in an area where there's a lot of service berries, they're spoiled. And in my, there's no other service berry I know of within blocks of my house. So,
so your yard is a treat.
How about traffic?
I think so. What? Traffic?
There's no traffic in your backyard. Animals are safe there.
Yeah. Well, that's true. In my backyard. My backyard's a haven compared to the others on my block, because there's not a lot of gardeners on my block. And in the summer, it's a jungle. And it gets chock full of birds and, you know, not really exotic types. And the other fauna, I get squirrels. And there are a few other things that show up. But mostly for birds, I would think it's a great place for them to be.
Right, and that's one of the reasons I never get a hazelnut off my American hazelnut is the squirrels, the blue jays, everything in the neighborhood will go after those nuts before they're really ripe enough for me to want to pick them. So it's a tough one that way.
All right, well, one of the reasons you guys are here is so that we can. I want at least folks listening today. And by the way, if you got a question about natives and getting started, or even augmenting something that you have, 312-985-7834, 312-985-7834. We'd be happy to accommodate you. I want to, as I said, kind of demystify. How do you start? Now, for instance, I've known about natives for a long time and really have very slowly added some. Let's start with a plant like bee balm or Monarda. Are you going to be one of those guys that tells me, oh no, you need bergamot, bee balm isn't good enough, Monarda is not good enough, because bergamot is they're different, slightly different plants. And would you explain the difference?
Well, there's a lot of cultivars of bee balm. Monarda is the botanical name,
right?
With more, you know, cotton candy pink as opposed to the native form, which is more of a purple pink. I think they're probably bred for less aggressiveness. Monarda, if you have a really small yard, Monarda might not be the plant for you, even though it's great for butterflies. because it'll form a colony, you know, 6 feet wide. And
yeah, but
three
they're not.
Deep.
It's not that hard to control. It's not. It's not hard to rip out because the roots are really shallow. You can really manipulate it easily, and that's one of the reasons I love. I love it because my grandmother grew it. Okay, mm-hmm. and I suspect that some of the plants in my yard actually I've lost track over the mist of times, but I think I managed to move some of them to my yard. So I think we're going on like a 40 or 50 year tradition where I've moved some of the same plants. And if not, I like to kid myself. But I know that native cultivars, or nativars, as some people call them, are still related to natives, and they still have a lot of the same properties, right?
Right. They can be, you know, a little bit shorter, so they might fit your needs better that way. but like you said, things can be controlled, and that's what I've been doing too a lot this spring. Whenever I have time, just divide, nip back, and get your gardens into control, because whether you're using natives or other ornamentals, you know, gardening can be a lot of work. If you don't put any work into it, it's not going to necessarily turn out the way you would like it to look.
Right, of course not, and that's one of the knock on native plants and gardens made with native plants is that they look weedy. It's weedy, but if you do it right, it's spectacular. In a way that the other plants, but you didn't answer my question. I'm putting you on the spot. Well, it's like, am I cheating by using Monarda, as a nativar?
You're talking about two different species then, as far as, because to me, bergamot and Monarda
are the same thing?
Are synonyms for the same plant. There's different species. Some might be from Europe. Some might be from North America. Yeah. They all serve the same function. The one that you normally find in the garden centers might be a deeper red.
Right.
And that actually might be a different species of
Monarda. Monarda didma is the one that usually is sold, right?
That's probably the deeper red one.
Is that is that North American or is that European?
Probably European. Ours is Fistulosa, Monarda Fistulosa.
Oh, I'm not ripping it out.
No, you don't need to, because you can mix, you know, nativars with natives, with, you know, local natives.
So I don't technically in that regard have a native. So that's the point, and I think that's kind of what confuses people, and makes them think I'm doing this wrong. So how do you start? How do you do it right?
But you can always mix. Obviously, you know, if you already are a gardener, you're going to have plants. You can move native plants into those. You don't have to start just a native garden. You can, you know, it's not against the rules to move in orange milkweed and next to a peony plant. So.
Exactly, and I'm not taking out my peony. It's beautiful. It doesn't spread. It's not, you know, it's not invasive. And I've got other things, but I'm trying to take some of those out. All right. Let's talk about a specific site. Okay, I'm going to put you guys put your heads together here. I got a parkway that I've been trying to put some natives into. For the longest time, I planted what would survive because parkways are tough. And I got a couple of ribes, and I don't think that they're natives. They don't bloom. I mean, they don't produce fruit. Let me put it. And ribes, by the way, is currant. I'd love to have currant shrubs that are actually producing fruit, which would be great. So I'd be happy to rip out the ones I have there and put those in. I've got, in the spring, I got my daffodils, and I posted a photo of my daffodils, and they're not native, folks. I'm copying to that right away. But I had some guy, I had this beautiful shot of the daffodils in full bloom a couple of weeks ago, and some guy, and I put it on Facebook, and some guy writes, "What? No natives?" And I'm like, "Oh, come on! Don't bust me for growing daffodils, because squirrels don't eat them. That's why you plant them." Because, you know, there's some practicalities here. But let's get back to the parkway. Let's say, it's harsh, it's dry, the soil's not the best in the world, which you don't necessarily need for some of the natives, that you need in certain conditions. What plants would you suggest to get me rolling on a parkway that gets, it's got some shade, not brutal sun? In fact, during the middle of the summer, when the sun is straight overhead, it's pretty shady during the day. Then in the spring and in the fall, it gets less shady. It's got sun. So give me some ideas. Nick?
That's actually usually how people approach me. They're like, I have this difficult area in my yard. And, you know, we kind of set on a course to try and figure out what that difficult area is.
Parkways are unique because they're getting blasted by salt and just, you know, people stepping on them constantly.
Right.
And so that makes it, yeah, dogs.
And that's the other thing that makes me crazy. I'm the only guy in my block that's growing stuff in my parkway. And so the people walking their dogs, all these other parkway plots that might have a tree, they're walking by them and they're getting to mine, and the dog, they let the dog pee in the shrub and every single plant that I've got in my parkway. I'm like, dudes, there's all these other parkways along the way, and they can let them pee against the tree down, you know, that Norway maple that's down the block. Let them pee into that.
Flowering pear.
Yes, exactly. But
yeah, hey, I'm trying to put some effort in here. Go to somebody's house that's not.
Yeah. Exactly. But get back to your story there.
So like some of the plants that I'd probably recommend, the combination of things makes it kind of challenging, it sounds like, because it's sort of shady,
right,
and it being mm-hmm. a parkway and stuff. But I think like wild onion would work pretty well, because that's usually a pretty resilient plant.
Allium.
Yeah, alliums.
Right.
Allium cernuum. And
cernuum? But there's many different alliums, so you have that one in particular?
Yeah.
And how do you spell cernuum?
Let's see. I'm not the best at spelling, so.
C-E-R-N-U-A-M?
C-E-R-N-U-U-M.
I'm sorry?
C-E-R-N-U-U-M.
Okay.
And that one's great because it's tolerant of many, like a wide spectrum. So it could take it a little bit wet, a little bit dry. It seems like it's pretty resilient, and it can take a little bit of shade too and some sun. So I think that, and it's shorter. So like mm-hmm. in a parkway, that would probably be a good selection.
Is that a white flower?
Yeah, it's got white to pink flowers, and it stays, you know, about a foot to 2 feet tall. Probably some other ones, Penstemon hirsutus, I think might be a good choice.
Ooh, see? Because why?
Because the same, that it can tolerate a wider spectrum, and it's relatively short.
A little
short.
Bit of dryness, a little bit of shade, a little bit of sun.
Yeah, and it seems
and,
like
and there are Penstemons out there, and there's a lot of, you know, hybrids out there and varieties. I don't. I'm maybe using the wrong word for it, but you know that have been cultivated. Husker Red is a very popular variety of Penstemon. But you would suggest Penstemon. What was this?
Hirsutus.
Because it has Penstemon. A beard. Is that it?
Yep.
All right.
That's tough.
Bearded Penstemon.
Yep. And it seems to maybe not be as aggressive as some of the other native Penstemons, because they can be a little bit aggressive too. So
okay. Any others that you would throw into that mix?
Do you want to toss in a couple, Keith?
I would mention sedges. I don't know if you're familiar with sedges.
Oh, love but, sedges. And I think sedges get a bad rap because people look at it and they say, I don't want grass, but it's not grass. It's much more interesting than grass. And which sedges would you recommend?
Yeah, and they're a nice compliment that if you step on them, they're not going to be completely damaged. But Carex jamesii, which is also known as grass sedge, grows low, maybe 6 or 8 inches high, tufted plant.
And by the way, Peggy's taking these down because I want that list.
Okay.
Because I don't want to have to go back and listen to the tape to write this down. So
I'm a thorough note taker. You're in good hands.
She's
here.
Good. I'm telling you, she's good. All right.
Palm sedge, Muskegamensis, which is a long name, but palm sedge grows a little bit taller, about 18 inches tall,
yeah.
With side leaves, somewhat like a palm tree if you have an active imagination. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, sedge is Carex.
Carex.
Genus,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're all in the Carex
So if
genus.
You see something, a Carex is the same as a sedge. And the thing about them is that they, like any grass, they produce inflorescences. I didn't pronounce that right. Inflorescence. There we go. Inflorescence, which is their bloom, and they're actually quite a pretty. They're subtle,
and they come up early.
But they're pretty.
So now this time of year, they're already up. Your other plants, whether you have hostas in that parkway, are still dormant. So you get a little bit of green early when you really want it. So even if you have daffodils, you have that also. The sedges. I like violets too, as far as a parkway. And there's more than just the common violet that you might see in any...
All over
maybe,
my lawn, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but you know, I learned recently that it hosts some... One a butterfly, and which butterfly?
The great spangled fritillary likes the violet. And if it doesn't have the violet to breed on,
I learned
you're not going to have the butterfly.
Right, from Doug Tallamy. Right. So for those of you who think you don't want violets in your lawn, think again, because A, they're pretty. And B, they're supporting local fauna.
And they're blooming right now. So when you're in a dearth of bloom, when before your other perennials are up and doing anything, the violets are already up and in flower. So you know, that's a nice combination, violets and sedges, as far as that goes. Yeah.
And probably a lot of the, I can't think of the name of it, it's the allium-type bulb that's blooming right now, little blue flowers everywhere. It's not an allium.
Oh, scilla? I think because that's not a native.
There's grape hyacinth that's blooming right now. It's really pretty. It's a,
it's a Dutch grape hyacinth. Yeah, it's a Dutch bulb, and it's lovely. But again, we're kind of focusing on natives here. Well, let me ask you that question while I got you both here. Natives really don't have that sort of spectacular appeal that those kinds of bulbs have, right? I mean, the reason we have tulips and daffodils and hyacinth, grape hyacinths and hyacinths is because they give you that instant gratification in the spring that the subtlety of the natives don't really have. Am I right in that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Dutch bulbs are popular because, of course, they're really tough. And like you mentioned with the daffodils, in my case, it's deer. If I planted tulips in my yard, the deer would find them. I'm still in the suburbs, but the deer seem to like tulips even in the suburbs. But something like Virginia bluebells is just as pretty as any tulip or daffodil.
I finally broke down after all these years, and the last couple of years I've been adding Virginia bluebells to my yard, and I know that they'll spread. I may have enough to get that going. I got like four or five plants.
I'll donate some.
Oh, fabulous. I'd love some.
Would you like some Trillium? I have lots of those too.
Are you kidding me?
No, they grow like weeds in my yard, seriously.
See,
I'll be bringing
it's,
a
life's
tray
not
for you.
Fair, is it? Yeah, because and Trillium's hard to transplant, isn't it? Or it can be tricky, can't it?
Trillium, well, it grows from a rhizome, just like like an iris, like a typical garden iris. So it's a fat, grubby looking little root that's it's relatively easy. You want to wait till after it's done flowering, or even when it's dormant would be ideal when it doesn't have any, because it only has one stem, and you're likely to crack that stem off when you're trying to move it during the growing season.
And you want to damage the energy coming into the plant, right?
Right, exactly. Another great plant for spring blooms, though, is Paskflower, and that blooms in April. So instead of crocus, it looks like a crocus flower, deep purple. All right. Sometimes it's white.
And this is addressed at Nick. One of the difficulties here is when you've got these plants that are ephemerals, which means that they pop up in the spring, and it's not like a tulip. When a tulip finishes, those leaves are there for two more months, and you know exactly where it is. And even if you buy or somebody digs up tulips and gives them to you, it's real easy to figure out where to put it, what it's going to look like. With like a Paskflower or some of these others that bloom early and then disappear, if you want to buy that in May or June, you're buying like a little pack of dirt and with roots in it and assuming that it's going to come back. You have to have faith. And that's a hard sell, isn't it, Nick?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I typically don't even – I stop selling the ephemerals at that point because I feel like people just see a pot with just dirt and they are like, you know.
See, I'm the one of the crazy ones. I'll buy it because I know it's cheaper.
Yeah, it's on
sale. And it's going to come back, and I'm going to have faith in it. But you're right. People, again, talking about instant gratification, they want to know what it looks like right now.
Well, that and trying to find it, because once the leaves die back and you're
– right. And then you might plant over it, and you got to be careful. I mean, it's really, you know, if you're like me and you're sort of a chaotic gardener, and I like that because I want my plants to spread and take, like the Monardas in the yard. They take off and they do stuff, and that's fine with me. That's a good point that the ephemerals are a tough sell after a certain point.
Yeah, even on top of that, most of them pull their roots back in, and when you pull it out of the pot, even though it was fully rooted in, it looks like you are just selling something you stuck in the pot that day.
Yeah,
because it's really just a bulb or, corum or whatever it is, and there's not much to it. So
all right, but there are Did you have something, Peggy?
Well, I was actually going to go back to the Parkway.
Okay, let's get back to the Parkway.
So what about for fall and winter interest? Shrubs. Something that's going to maintain the height, maintain some bulk, so it's not just, well, there's a garden there in the summer, but nothing in the winter. Something that's going to survive piles of snow and salt.
I like Discampsia, which is tufted hair grass. It stays somewhat evergreen even throughout the winter. So a lot of grasses, once you get that first snow, like this past year in November, we got that heavy, wet snow, and all our ornamentals that we wanted to carry through the winter just got smashed down and never popped back up. But the Scampsia, it's a short grass, maybe a foot high and a foot wide, and it's native to northern Illinois. Works well with a lot of different plants, including as basically a ground cover around other shrubs. So if you had the service berry or you had a smooth hydrangea, you could plant that around the base along. It's not winter interest, but a combination would be along with the wild geranium or the woodland geranium. So, you know.
Oh, well, let's talk about geranium because I want to make sure I'm growing the right one. I've got I've got geranium and I love. What's the botanical name for the wild geranium that you're talking about?
It'd be Geranium maculatum is the most common. There's also Bicknellii, but Geranium maculatum.
And I think I have it. And is one of the characteristics that it has that odd smell that's sort of a no?
I've never. You have to get pretty low, and I guess if you maybe – I've never smelled a
I think I have it, and I'm not – is it a sort of a thicker lobed leaf?
You're thinking of
what's the other? I think I have it.
This is the native geranium, but I know the one with the little pink flowers, and it has a very
actually they're more purple.
It's low. It's got a very distinctive aroma to it.
Very distinctive aroma, and it mats very nicely, and it has this great masses of purple flowers, which will probably bloom in a couple of weeks for me, maybe a little longer. So I got a feeling, again, it's not native. Okay. You know, and I'm loathe to rip it out.
It's
because
a crane's bill.
No.
Yeah, but that's a geranium.
But that's not the wild native.
No. Yeah.
There are nice cultivars of geraniums that are re-blooming or bloom for a long time. There's a Geranium biokovo, which is from, you know, probably from Turkey or Eastern Europe, but the geranium, the native geranium, would work well, I think, in your parkway because it's a savanna.
We'll write it down anyway there, Peggy. Oh, sanguineum.
Oh.
That might be what I have.
The geranium sanguineum.
Right, which is a crane's bill.
Yeah.
It's the same. Crane's bill is a common name.
Yeah, that's the very small little one.
Yeah, it might be. I think I might have a sanguineum. But we haven't even gotten into the spectacular plants, like the prairie, the so-called, and I'm using air quotes again, prairie plants that people think of. I mean, I have cup plant that I put in my yard, a decade ago and is everywhere and in the whole neighborhood, in cracks in the sidewalk, in cracks in the alley. And that's okay. I don't care because I know it's doing good and it collects water and birds and insects can drink from that. But you can find less invasive. And that's the other thing. A native plant can be invasive too, can't it?
I usually call them aggressive instead of it being – because invasive, okay, aggressive, to me has like a different term, meaning that it's detrimental to ecology.
Yeah.
But I would say that, there's definitely like in terms of like your yard, there's aggressive ones. And if you have a larger yard, that could be a benefit. And I see benefits and downsides to it.
Yeah.
Or you have some that are really conservative and barely spread at all. Like typically like a lot of, like say a trillium or something. But, in your case, it seems like it's doing really well. But there, it kind of goes, it runs the gamut between more aggressive and then less aggressive plants.
Yeah.
And so the scale of your yard has to come into play when you're thinking about that.
Keith?
And sometimes if you're just starting out a garden and these natives are flowering and setting seed, they're dropping on bare ground, so of course they're going to want to, sprout from that situation. So I suggest putting down a few inches of wood mulch because I've seen where it hasn't been mulched in, I get a lot of little volunteer seedlings.
Sure.
But if I put 2 inches of even just 2 inches of wood mulch, it cuts back on a lot of that maintenance that you would.
Give me two or three plants that you like for full sun that are what you would consider more of the spectacular types. And that's a relative term.
I like all of the Baptisias, and there's probably half a dozen different types of Baptisias. It's also called false prairie indigo. There's a blue Baptisia, which will get large, 4 feet tall and 4 feet wide. There's white Baptisia. that sends up one or two stems and then an umbrella of foliage so you can still plant ground covers or other plants underneath it. These are all for full sun. Then the first time I saw the cream baptisia was at the Morton Arboretum in the Schulenburg Prairie, and I had no idea what it was. It was the most beautiful plant, just low-growing with these huge cream-colored spikes of bloom out at the ends of the branches, yeah. But really cool plant. So it pretty much can't go wrong with any of the baptisias. They're very, very well maintained. Or they look like they're maintained as far as you don't have to do a lot to them.
What about you, Nick?
One of my favorite plants is Liatris scariosa. So that's Savannah blazing star, and that it's really pretty. But
all
then,
right, the question is: it Liatris? Is it Liatris? Is it Liatris? Nobody knows, right? Because Latin is a dead language.
However you want to say it.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
What I say.
But it's, yeah, you've seen it. It's one of the most beautiful plants out there, and it's a stalk that is just covered like a bottle brush that is
yeah.
purple.
Of like neon purple flowers.
Yeah, yeah.
And then even beyond its beauty is how well that plant attracts adult butterflies. If you plant it in, say, if you get a group of 20 of those together, if anybody goes to my website and looks at the Liatris scariosa on there, I've got a video of my grandma's house where we planted about a flat, so about 38 plants together. And there must be,
wow.
I don't know, 40 butterflies, monarchs, swallowtails, all kinds of stuff. It's crazy
That's
how many
great.
Butterflies it attracts.
Well, listen, we're flat out of time here. I've been a bad host because I haven't reintroduced you in all this time. But you were just hearing Nick Fuller, who is the owner and principal ecologist with Natural Communities Native Plants. You've heard them on my program. They're a sponsor right now. Naturalcommunities.net is the website. Tell me about events where people can come and get plants. Obviously, they can get them online at naturalcommunities.net, but you also have some events where you can meet people.
Yeah, we have our next event is on May 7th with the Conservation Foundation in Naperville. And today's actually the closing date for pre-orders for that event. But there's also going to be day of plant sales. And then next one after that, we have an event on May 14th, Gardenology in Geneva. And then another one, May 21st, Blooming Fest in West Chicago. And then the last one, again, this one's a pre-order only event, and this is with the Greater DuPage Wild Ones. That event is on May 22nd. So you can catch all those on my website underneath events.
Great, great. Yes, Keith.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't publicize my own
yes, you
native
would.
Plant sale from the Illinois Native Plant Society. My group, the Kankakee Torrent chapter, on May 28th, we're having a plant sale at Camp Shaw, which is just west of Manteno, town of Manteno. And beautiful place. They have one of the few limestone canyons in Illinois. So not only
wow.
can you get your native plants, but take a nice walk and view that canyon.
And you pointed out something to me that I put on my own website, Keith, which is the Illinois Native Plant Society has a wonderful page of native plant sales. And you can go on there and click. I mean, there's so many in the Chicago region, and just click on them.
Right, and statewide. So anything, even in Wisconsin,
yeah,
well, there's some listed.
Minnesota
and
Indiana. I mean, it covers the whole Midwest
right,
region.
Now is the time for plant sales. April, May, and June is a great time to seek those out.
Well, gentlemen, this has been a treat. This has just been awesome. Keith, it's been too long since we've chatted, and we need to do it again soon. And Nick, I'm wishing you the greatest success. And folks, if you are a homeowner and you want some natives, and you know you're not going to buy them wholesale because you got a small yard, you got to talk to Nick. And don't just leave yourself at the mercies of the box stores. Now, you can leave yourself at the mercy sometimes of good independent garden centers because they have experts. They're not going to have all the variety. They're not going to have 150 varieties like Nick has, but it might not be a bad place to start if you want to dip your toe in the water. And then go to his website. See what he's got. You've got the list there, I assume, Nick.
Yeah, all the plants are listed on there. They're categorized by shady, sunny, kind of the way we were talking about today.
So. Yeah. So do that. And of course, they're a sponsor on the Mike Novak Show. So that's one of the reasons I'm doing that. Gentlemen, you are going to be back on the show as quickly as I can possibly arrange it and have a wonderful Sunday. It's a good day to get out there and work in the garden, isn't it?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. It's good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, unless you've been living under a rock like a centipede or a roly-poly, you probably know that our pollinators are facing a lot of challenges. My friend Gene Starr has some great advice in the March-April issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine about what to do if you're interested in raising bees. It's pretty simple. Join a beekeepers association and rub elbows with folks who have done it before. The best line of her article is this, quote, "You've never smelled honey until you've been to a clover hive that has just been harvested." Have you ever heard that before?
No.
Clover honey, I hear, is the best. But come on, most of you grab this issue because it comes with the 2016 Resource Guide, which is a handy booklet about everything horticultural in the Chicago area. Or you might grab it because of my column on the Inside Back Page.
That's reason alone.
Yeah, but who's kidding whom? Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, a publication of state-by-state gardening magazines. Go to chicagolandgardening.com. But if you're in other parts of the Midwest or the South, try one of the 21 magazines in those areas by going to statebystategardening.com or call 888-265-3600, 888-265-3600.
It's not just your garden. It's the way you live.
And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow. With Bonnie.
Did you know Chicagoans are getting healthier all the time? Hi, I'm Peggy, and I know this is true because for 6 years I've been publishing Natural Awakening, Chicago's greenest and healthiest magazine. And if you want your message to reach this growing market, you do need to get your business in front of our readers. Why? Because our advertisers tell us that our targeted readers are committed to improving their health and ready to take action. That's more than 80,000 people in Chicagoland who will respond to your message. They're looking for holistic wellness practitioners, integrative doctors and dentists, nutritionists, health coaches, yoga instructors, even home improvement and landscape experts. Natural Awakenings is a free monthly magazine available in more than 1,100 locations throughout Cook, Lake, and McHenry counties. Call me today to expand your market and grow your business. 847-858-3697. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good. Live simply. Laugh more.
Want to make a positive move in the housing market? Replace your siding and windows. You'll improve your home's look and energy efficiency, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling and energy needs. Siding, windows, solar and wind power, and more. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
I ain't got nobody. Oh, and there's nobody that cares for me. There's nobody that cares for me. Nobody.
I guess I shouldn't start trying to sing over Louis Prima. That's just kind of rude, don't you think?
Especially if you're playing Louis Prima for the movie The Big Night.
Yeah, Louis Prima and Smith, Kylie Smith, Kayla, blah blah. Now Kathleen's going to be mad at me because I can't remember his singing partner, but just wonderful musicians. And that's Rick DeMaio over there, meteorologist extraordinaire. How are you, Rick?
I'm doing fine, Mike. How are you? Are your pipes okay? Everything running through your body at the right efficiency level?
The pipes have held on pretty well.
That's good.
I'm thrilled with that, actually. Other stuff
and
is...
And as you can hear, my dog's pipes are pretty good as well. Quiet! Go on, I'm listening.
Oh, that's okay. You don't need to hear. I actually told a story earlier about what's been going on And I'm holding up pretty well right now. So in another
That's
week.
Good. Good to hear.
Yeah, thanks. And I appreciate your concern, and thank you for your good wishes.
It sounded okay in the radio, huh? That's good.
You know, I think it's just it's the adrenaline kicking in right now, and and when I get out of here, I'm going to collapse into a heap. But that's okay. I'll just take it easy and
don't push it.
Nope, not going to push it after this. I just needed to get through 2 hours here. And while I was in intensive care, it was 80 degrees in Chicago. But I guess,
you missed one. There'll be more. There's going to be one today. So as long as you get out today, you'll feel like what happened last week wasn't that big of a deal. But typical April in Chicago, isn't it? Right.
Absolutely. It waxes and it wanes, and one day it's 80, and the next is 50, and that's kind of what we're looking at here, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and you think about like what happened on Friday when the cold front came through, and it brought us basically back down to earth with, you know, temperatures in the 40s along the lakefront and winds out of the north at 20 to 25 miles an hour, and people walking their dogs along the beautiful shorelines of Lake Michigan with hats and gloves on. And even though it was nice out yesterday with a lot of sun, you can still get a sunburn this time of the year, as I got a little bit of a burn yesterday.
Really?
You know, it was only in the low 50s. Yeah, it was only in the low 50s yesterday, and now the winds turn around to the south, and we've gotten rid of the Greenland block, which means that our weather is going to begin to basically become a little bit more progressive over the next couple of days and couple of weeks. So this is going to be the beginning of a very active weather pattern, beginning with some storms that move through much of the high plains today. There's actually an enhanced risk for the possibility of severe weather. It looks like a fairly good tornado outbreak sets up pretty much from the Dakotas down into Nebraska, Kansas, and Oklahoma. And we'll get the remnants of that tomorrow. And then we get back into much cooler weather for Tuesday and Wednesday before another round of severe weather, potentially deadly severe weather, on Thursday in the Central Plains. So once you remove that blocking pattern that typically you get into every once in a while in the latter half of spring, the atmosphere just reloads itself, and it's almost like a Gatling gun of storms that's basically creating across the western United States. Unfortunately, it looks like the bulk of the rain, though, should end up kind of to the south of us on this. All the storm tracks are generally moving from the southern Rockies across the Central Plains and into parts of the Northeast, and we could use a little bit of rain, even though the ground has had some decent, you know, soakings from, you know, rains that occurred early in the month of March. We can just a little bit to kind of help things along a little bit. But, you know, Mike, it's amazing just in the last 2 weeks how much things have gone from brown to a lighter shade of green to a darker shade of green. And
wow.
And you also see all the different things beginning to pop up as well. It's been an amazing 2 weeks, and it'll be amazing another 2 weeks as well.
Well, I got to tell you, Rick, when you spend 9 days away from home, and I came back on Thursday, and everything was blooming, and I went, wow,
right.
when did that happen? It's
right.
It was unbelievable.
And especially for someone like you who looks at just about every little thing that does come up.
Right, I do.
All of a sudden, you realize when you're walking just one little view down the street, you say, wow, I can't see as far down the street as I used to because, you know, the little buds and the leaves are coming out. But this is interesting. I was up in Milwaukee yesterday. I was visiting my son as I was at school up there. And just the difference between getting over the state line and into the city of Milwaukee, particularly the northeast part of the city where the university is, and you're right up against the lakefront where it's always colder up there than any other part of Wisconsin, it seems like. There was not a single tree in bloom, none. And it all of a sudden, I felt like I went back almost a month in time because all the trees were just still basically what they look like during the wintertime, all brown, nothing bloom. And then you drive 90 miles south and half the trees are already in bloom.
Right.
So it was interesting, I think, from that standpoint. You went back in time or went forward in time just by mileage, and for you it took 9 days. But this time of the year, it is amazing. The last 2 weeks of April into the first week of May, I always said it's when really the marvels of nature and the wonders of climate and the wonders of what put all these, you know, things on the earth that they do things on their own without the help of us, instead of, you know, we may hurt them to some degree, you know, all shows its true beauty, you know, for free. And yeah. It is quite amazing. And I hope that, you know, parents are getting their kids away from their electronic devices, out of the house, walking around, stopping, looking at stuff. It doesn't mean you have to go to, you know, the botanical garden. You have to go downtown. Just walking around your neighborhood, seeing these things, is special. And sometimes you never know. You may pique a kid's interest to the point where they go, "Oh, that's cool." And then they'll say, "That's cool, and that's cool, and that's cool." Next thing you know, 20 years from now, they own their own, you know, flower shop or nursery or stuff like that. And they'll go back to that one seminal moment where they remember their dad or their mom showing them something, and boom, next thing you know, things click. So this is a really important time for everybody to be outside doing something.
You know, getting back to the Milwaukee thing, I have a friend who is a gardener in Milwaukee. So I've known this for years. And she complains that they're at least 2 weeks, sometimes 3 and 4 weeks behind Chicago. Mm-hmm. And it seems odd because they're, as you mentioned, they're only 90 miles to the north, but they might as well be in Hudson Bay.
Yeah. It is quite amazing how much cooler that part of Southeast Wisconsin is. And even when I went to school at UW in Madison, you know, we would routinely look at the temperature in Milwaukee along the lakefront, and it was 46 degrees with a lake breeze and clouds and fog, while it was 59 with sunshine in Madison. But that part of Southeast Wisconsin, they'll get a lake breeze pretty much from about 180 degrees from the north, northeast, east, southeast, and even sometimes from the south. Where for us, our lake breeze, if it comes in from the south and east, is warmed up by all the, you know, pollution from Gary, Indiana. So we can thank the steel mills for warming up our lake breeze, I guess, to some degree. But it is true. That part of Southeast Wisconsin, it's unbelievable how much cooler it is. And I've seen it for many years, how much later everything seems to bloom up there. And like I saw it yesterday. And you have to do it when things are blooming. And then when they're not blooming, then you really see the difference. And I definitely saw it there yesterday.
One of your biggest fans in the world is W.C. Turk, and he hangs around here in the studio for most of my show, puttering around and doing this and that. And then when DeMaio Weather, and I've decided that, and actually wrote this yesterday on Facebook, and it made me think of something, Rick, that I called it, that I said you'd be on the show with Rick DeMaio, Climate and Weather. And can you imagine what kind of a stir you would cause if a local meteorologist was introduced as so-and-so climate and weather?
Yeah, and the only person that ever really talks about climate is Skilling. And I think it's part of our job to talk about climate and climate change and climate variability. And you know, there was this program at Benedictine University this past Thursday, which had James Hansen from NASA, well, formerly from NASA, who is probably one of the leading advocates of doing something to alter the human interaction, you know, anthropogenic warming. And he was highly criticized for being an advocate. Usually scientists, they produce the science and let someone else be the advocate. But Tom got to introduce him and was talking a lot about, you know, different things that are going on around the world. And someone had posed the question to James Hansen, at what point did he realize that this was happening? And he said, oh, it was probably in the early to mid-80s. And then someone posed the question to Tom. And Tom said, well, you know, I was actually a denier for a while, but that's a good thing to be on that side of it, because it allows you to, if you are a true scientist, to consider all sides. And it was really about 15 years ago when you started to spend more time up in Alaska, when you saw these things changing. And I remember when I was on TV, I put a couple of images up about the shrinking ice pack, and someone would come up to me and said, You actually said, you posed the question, is the climate warming? They go, well, aren't you editorializing stuff? I'm like, no, I posed the question. I didn't say it is, but maybe we should be thinking about this. And, you know, yeah, do I pat myself on the back for doing that? Yeah, I guess to some extent. But I came from a different, you know, I came from a different discipline of watching the weather and learning about the weather. And sure enough, when they gave the microphone to people in the audience to ask questions, you always got to worry about the first person. They're usually the ones that can't wait to get up there
right.
and just start spouting out this prepared question that they've had. And the guy gets up there and he says, you know, it's nice to have you here. I'm a physical engineer. I've been working since the first Earth Day to help protect the Earth. And I just wanted to let you know. And you're like, you're looking at him saying, like, what's the question? And he basically came out and said, I'm one of the 30,000 scientists in the United States that signed this petition that says that humans have no impact on the Earth. And you started to hear people hissing and booing and stuff like that. And he basically was land-based in Hansen for doing his work. And really, I give my hats off to Tom because he took the microphone and he said, well, you know, I understand that you've been part of this petition to 30,000 people, and you've brought it up before in your show. He goes, do you know that many of these people who proclaim themselves to be scientists aren't really scientists per se, and there's actually people on there who are dead. And one of them was one of the Spanish explorers, Cortez, who was supposed to be a scientist. And Tom came quickly out and said, may I ask you what your background is in climate? And everybody started to applaud because clearly Skilling was basically undressing this person, you know, figuratively and showing his true colors that he was not a climate scientist. And the audience just started to applaud. And actually, I was the third person who was going to get up and pose a question to Hansen, which was about the use of more efficient burning of coal in China and India, which there probably needs to be. And he's like, no more coal. And part of me wanted to say, I need to address this guy who just gave this, you know, horrible thing about the 30,000 people. But the other voice in the back of my head said, don't. You know, you have like three voices going, the one that's talking, the one that says what you're going to say, and the one that says probably what you shouldn't say. And the one that said what they shouldn't say was the one that won, and I didn't say anything. Because it would have embarrassed him, and it wasn't my place to do that. But it's amazing how you always get one in the crowd that tries to denounce science. And it was sad that he did it, but it was good because it just makes people who are supposedly, or I shouldn't say supposedly, but people who are trying to advocate some form of understanding of the science, to be a little bit more better educated, a little bit more informed, and a little bit more on the defensive sometimes. But it's a shame that we have to do that, but this other side forces us to do that.
Yeah, it is a shame. They can be really vocal and disruptive. I mean, I think you.
I don't understand the disruptive part.
Right. Yeah. You have a right to be heard, but like you said, this is a guy who was lying in wait, and was going to spring
right.
and immediately stick a stick into the spokes of the bicycle and just
right.
see what
right.
chaos he could cause.
And you can understand the people who get. Paid, you know, in a really insidious way by oil companies or some other interest, in order to do that.
Yeah.
But it's the people that pick up the baton and do it for nothing
right.
Is the scary part.
Yeah. So and getting back to Bill Turk here, and I introduce this whole, but I'm waiting for the day when I turn on Channel 2 and they say, and now. Chicago,
no.
climate and weather brought to you by, it is not going to happen,
I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that. I don't need to do that anymore.
Well, it wasn't you. I necessarily going to be doing it, but, I'm just saying if anybody, any one of them did
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
That's the point I'm making. It says, I'm not pointing at you and saying you should be doing this. I'm saying anybody just stand up and say what we do here when we present the weather is not just the weather. We're giving you
right.
it. We'll give it to you in context as well.
But there's not
enough time for context.
The weather is part of something.
Yeah.
Well, I think that could change, and it probably is different in other parts. I mean, I've watched weather in, you know, Idaho Falls, and the person actually gave a showed a map of recent precipitation. I think I sent you something as well.
Yeah, you did.
And the person said, yeah, the person said, this is how much rain we've had over the last 45 days. This is the percent of normal. This is the discharge in the Idaho River and the Snake River. And this is where we've had recent fires and burn areas. And this is where we think things could be, you know, susceptible when we get into this hot weather. And I said, wow, that's really cool. He didn't just go through the normal, here's today's high, here's today's low, here's the satellite, here's the radar, here's the futurecast, here's the local forecast for your area, blah, blah, blah. He gave a scientific explanation about what he thought is going to happen and what is going to happen. So I think we're kind of skewed by living in a big city where you have to, you know, you have to marginalize certain things that may not be, you know, appropriate for the viewers. But it is amazing when you get into different parts of the country, you do see something like that. You really do. But the bottom line is, I think what you're making, Mike, is it's not enough.
Yeah.
And it's easy to do. It really is easy. Now here's what Skilling does, and he walks a fine line. He doesn't do it on his broadcast, but he does it in his blog, and he does it on his webpage, and he'll do it in the Tribune paper. So he has all those different, you know, vehicles to promote that.
Yeah.
But shame on all the other TV people who also have the opportunity to do that on their websites, and they don't. And I think it's a real cop out. It really is a cop out. And there's nothing wrong with presenting science as long as it pertains to your audience in a positive way. And there's nothing wrong with that, but they're afraid to do it.
Well, I was just going to say, instead of the 30 seconds where you say, and now photographs sent to us from people, oh, here's another sunset. Isn't that exciting? And, you know, give me 30 seconds of climate change, all right? Or talk about the climate for 30.
Right.
I mean, you've got the time on television is so precious. And you know that better than anybody, Rick. There's nothing left. And they squeeze every little bit out of it. So when I see those people wasting 30 seconds of time with stupid photographs, I'm not interested in your pictures of your sunsets. I'd rather get a little bit more information because there's so little of it out there in the first place.
Right. If the sunset is more brilliant due to the fact that an earthquake, you know, blew its top.
Bingo.
In Iceland. And then you can say, you know, part of our natural climate variability, you know, 15 million years ago was due to the fact that volcanoes spewed, you know, huge amounts of sulfur dioxide and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and was one of the reasons for the warming of the planet. That takes 12 seconds to do, and it can be done. And you know what? Every once in a while, you get the anchor looking at you going, they'll go, really? That's interesting. Or you'll get someone like Walter Jacobson, who I work with for 5 years, look at me and go, huh? And then later on in the hallway would go, he goes, I don't know what you were saying there, but I am interested. But at that moment, I had no idea. So Walter was always fixed on what the next 6 seconds were going to be. In fact, there were times, and I can tell you this because I've laughed about it with him, if he was working the anchor desk by himself, he would actually practice the segues with me. He goes, okay, so we come out of the break, I'm going to say this, and you're going to say this. Is that okay? And I look at him, I go, yeah, that's fine. He goes, okay, let's work on it now. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, good, that sounds good. And he would come out of the break, he would say exactly that. I go, look at me, he goes, that went well. And he was never able to do it from a natural standpoint, but in the end, he was always interested in science and always interested in that, but he was of the old school where it had to have its place.
Right.
In the newscast. He didn't like it when it came out of left field. He wasn't a fan of that.
I'm a total fan of that. I think I'm a total fan of that. I love the digression. I love the tangential thought. I love somebody saying one word and it sparks a conversation for 20 minutes. No, that's
Oh yeah.
And I think you are too.
And sometimes you'll get, you know, someone like a Mark Sepulveda, enable Tom to say that last 30 seconds. But usually it's the floor director waving the finger, we got to go. And then the anchor just goes, okay, great, thanks.
Yeah.
Then later he'll go, well, I don't know what you were saying there, but we had to go. The, the red light was coming and I had to stop the car.
Yeah.
That was one of those things. But the bottom line is, I think the debate here is, when do, you know, meteorologists or weathercasters on TV truly expound, you know, the important virtues of science through climate and climate change, because it does matter. And as Hansen spoke very eloquently at Benedictine College, and Tom Skilling for introducing him, and there was a huge audience. It was Bill Congressman Bill Foster was there, and Seth Darley was there from Argonne. I got to speak with both of them. And when you have a congressman, who, you know, Bill Foster is an ex-scientist, still a scientist to some degree, show up at a talk like that, that's pretty big stuff. And he actually flew in from D.C. for it to make sure that he was part of it, because it is in his district as well, so that's a good thing. But that's pretty big stuff, and that is so lacking in our government today, is having someone who just literally is just looking at the facts and making a decision on it. So good for Congressman Bill Foster.
Well, I had introduced Bill because I was going to have him, because he's a huge fan, and he always has something he wants to ask you, but we just sucked up.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Was there anything on your plate there, Bill, that you wanted to bring up?
No, we'll get to it a little bit later. I was, while you guys were talking, I was going over climate data, something when Rick spoke about Iceland and volcanoes. One of the things that sparked my interest right away, and it's just the ADD working, was the effect that Mount St. Helens had on the climate, and then how that fit into the overall pattern of climate change since the 1940s. And what was Mount St. Helens was roughly, what, about 1980, 81, 82?
Yeah, I believe it was 80.
It really didn't have much effect, mainly because of the type of particles that were in Mount St. Helens pyroclastic explosion settled to the ground very quickly. In fact, very little of it actually made it even here to Illinois, which is quite interesting. Part of it was the fact that the weather pattern during that particular time was like a northwest flow. So the outflow, if you want to call it that, literally made a right turn and went between, like, say, 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock, you know, between the east and the southeast, and basically made it across most of Idaho, areas of Wyoming, parts of Utah and Montana. So because that flow, as fantastic as it looked in the isolated view of St. Helens, didn't really make it around the earth. It had to do, I think, more so with the conditions that were occurring at that time. The troposphere was actually fairly low, so it kind of flattened out and pushed to the south and east. But it didn't have the same physical structure as, say, Mount Pinatubo did, which, even though it was down in the Philippines, that was a very dusty volcano. Mm-hmm. And the troposphere over the Philippines usually is up to about 45,000, 50,000 feet, with the height of the troposphere, which is basically the lowest level of the atmosphere of Mount St. Helens.
Yeah.
During that time, it was only about 20,000 to 30,000 feet. It was fairly low. So it only had about, you know, you didn't have as much room for the cloud to plume out, so to say. But the thing with Pinatubo was very dusty, and the particles were such that there was a huge amount of reflectivity off of the incoming solar radiation. So once that plume literally went into the northern latitudes and around the Earth almost two or three times, which meant it stayed in the atmosphere a long period of time, that had a dramatic impact on temperatures in the northern latitudes about a period of time, about 6 to about 18 months after that. Following the eruption of Pinatubo, we had about a period of about maybe 6 to 8 months of very, very active weather in the northeast and in western parts of Europe, which we were predicting, but we were off by about 6 months, and it happened to be right during the wintertime. And when you get natural variability occur with, if you want to call it unnatural variability, which would have been, I should say, an external feedback is the sun, and internal feedback is a volcano, is the best way to say it. So when you have that external and internal feedback occur at the same time, then you're going to have massive changes. It's like having a flat tire. And your car is not going to do very well over the next two blocks. So that's an internal feedback. And external feedback with driving a car on a flat tire and you hit a pothole. So the internal feedback is the car going boom, 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 boom because of the flat tire. The combination of the internal and the external will be the flat tire hitting the pothole, and now you have a dented wheel and a cracked axle. So the dented wheel and the cracked axle was the period of time where we had extremely violent weather in the Northeast and also on the western coast of Europe. But with Mount St. Helens, the internal feedback was weak, and there was no external feedback. So the overall climate, if you want to call it changes, were almost minimal. And that was kind of interesting to learn from that particular one.
And against the backdrop of climate change or global warming, we've continued to warm. So Pinatubo and then subsequent volcanic eruptions really hasn't had much of an effect, or doesn't seem to have had much of an effect on the rise of the mean temperature of the planet. Am I correct in that?
I think what you're asking is the current warming of the atmosphere, mostly due to human-induced warming, is not going higher due to the fact that we don't have volcanic activity. Is that what you're saying?
No. I'm saying that, you know, for a lot of these naysayers about man-made global warming, they always point to natural events affecting that. That process, but we've continued very precipitously. We've continued to get warmer despite these natural events, which you would think would mitigate that.
Right. What you really have to do is you have to outline six reasons why the Earth's climate has gone through its cycles and its variation, and then when you pull five of those out, the only one left is human-induced warming. My comment usually to people who are the naysayers, I go, okay, if you don't believe that humans are altering the climate through the input of increased greenhouse gases, would you agree that then humans are being affected by the variations in climate? You can't deny that. That's such an – so I always start out with, do you believe? And then I'll go, no. I go, well, then do you believe that humans are affected by it?
Yeah.
And if they say no, they have their head in the sand, because the number of the billion-dollar disasters that we have seen over the last 25 years is off the charts. And in addition to that, I say, okay, now tell me about the population of the world. If we've been stuck at 1.5 billion for the last 50 years, I'm fine with that. But we're at 7.2 and projected to go to 11. That's like opening up one supermarket in a city of a million people. You're not going to feed everybody. Mm-hmm. So what do? You have to build more supermarkets. It's simple. I mean, the math is so easy. So when I try to not convince, but I try to educate students on this, I always give them like one of those little like cutouts you can put in your wallet. So if you do get into one of these arguments at a party, And you feel like the person is just like really talking too much, take a break, go into the bathroom, pull it out of your wallet, read it, and then go back out and into the conversation, and just nail them. And it's so easy. And you don't have to be mad. You don't have to be angry. You just say, well, let me ask you this. It's kind of like the last scene of the movie A Few Good Men, when Tom Cruise was trying to get Jack Nicholson to say, did he order a Code Red? He led him up to the point where he said, did you give two orders? Yes. Why? Do your men follow orders? Yes. Well, why did this happen? And literally, he got him basically to the edge of the platform, and he didn't push Jack Nicholson into the pool of sharks. He jumped, and on his own. And it was beautiful writing. It was beautiful acting. And oftentimes, in the argument of discussing climate, it's just basically knowing the facts to be really, really simple. It's not that hard after all.
Wow. Well, we're in overtime with meteorologist Rick DeMaio, and this has been great. No, I'm telling you, this is a good welcome back, and I'm going to put this whole show up on the podcast because the whole show has been spectacular, and you've just been part of it, Rick. So let's give us a forecast, and I'll let you get out of here.
Okay, sure, yeah. So the wind turned southwest today, 80 degrees all the way up to the lakefront. That would be the first time since last September we've done that. Big storm system, probably tornado watches all the way from the Dakotas into Oklahoma today. Remnants of that will get in here tomorrow. So it'll be a much warmer morning tomorrow. Probably mid-70s with high clouds and scattered showers and a couple of thunderstorms on Monday. excuse me, a big high pressure pushes south. So we go back into cool northeast winds and probably about a 20-degree drop-off on Tuesday. But then the atmosphere reloads very quickly. We're back with warm weather and rain during the day on Wednesday. We could see severe weather around here on Thursday, but from between now and probably the next 14 days, temperatures probably 1 or 2 days during that period of time above normal, 4 or 5 days below normal. So we'll probably average about 3 to 5 degrees below normal between now and the next 14 days. And rainfall probably below normal as well. It looks like the storm track is going to be mainly to the south, which should be good for the farmers and things like that.
Yeah.
But overall, you know, you don't want to say just, you know, end it with just saying typical April stuff. It's going to be cooler than normal and drier than normal, but it's going to seem like it's rained a lot, but we're not going to get much rainfall out of it, as I guess the best way to say.
So don't get fooled, although it's not time to panic and, you know, overwater.
But you know what, Mike? Overall, the pattern does not bode well for any return to any frost. So we're completely done with that.
We've
broken through the Greenland block. Yeah, we've broken through the Greenland block. So no concerns about frost or freezes or that. We're completely done with that. We had temperatures in the, you know, the low to mid 30s yesterday, and the ground temperature is pretty warm. But the way the pattern is shaping up, we're completely done with that.
And we're not going to talk about it now, but maybe next week, because it sounds like it's been a kind of quiet, severe weather season across the United States.
Well, you know what? It's been quiet in the Midwest. But if you go from December 1st to the end of March, the severe weather has been from Texas into Louisiana and Mississippi. You know, over 40 people have been killed in 5 different events, mainly due to the strong El Nino. And that's typically what you get. You get more winter-type severe weather. But because the pattern hasn't been able to establish itself in the central plains and the upper Midwest, it seems to be quiet for us. But nationally, it's still well above average, but it's been above average in a different place.
I stand corrected.
You don't stand corrected. You stand educated.
All right, Mr. DeMaio, you're awesome. You're just awesome, and good to talk to you again. And we'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good. Have a happy Sunday, everybody.
All right, you
thanks,
too.
Rick.
And Peggy Malecki. Give me 2 seconds on Natural Awakenings magazine. Let's give yourself a plug here.
Well, we are the healthy living go-to magazine for the Chicago area. Our new May issue is going to hit the streets this coming week.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Focused on women's wellness, talking anything from women's heart health to some beauty tips and healthy recipes, and looking forward to June then.
And W.C. Turk, thank you so much for being my backup here.
Always,
today.
Man.
And with that, I just say go green or
go home.
And I am home. I'm home, Toto.